Chapter 130 involves a serious catastrophe. The little racecourse at Hampton was in the full tide and height of its gaiety, the day as dazzling as day could be, the sun high in the cloudless sky, and shining in its fullest splendor. Every gaudy color that fluttered in the air from carriage seat and garish tent top shone out in its gaudiest hues. Old dingy flax grew new again, faded gilding was reburnished, stained rotten canvas looked a snowy white, the very beggar's rags were freshened up, and sentiment quite forgot its charity in its fervent admiration of poverty so picturesque. It was one of those scenes of life and animation, caught in its very brightest and freshest moments, which can scarcely fail to please. For if the eye be tired of show and glare, or the ear be weary with a ceaseless round of noise, the one may repose, turn almost where it will, on eager, happy, and expectant faces, and the other deaden all consciousness of more annoying sounds in those of mirth and exhilaration. Even the sunburnt faces of gypsy children, half naked though they be, suggest a drop of comfort. It is a pleasant thing to see that the sun has been there, to know that the air and light are on them every day, to feel that they are children, and lead children's lives, that if their pillows be damp, it is with the dews of heaven, and not with tears, that the limbs of their girls are free, and that they are not crippled by distortions, imposing an unnatural and horrible penance upon their sex, that their lives are spent, from day to day, at least among the waving trees, and not in the midst of dreadful engines which make young children old, before they know what childhood is, and give them the exhaustion and infirmity of age, without, like age, the privilege to die. God send that old nursery tales were true, and that gypsies stole such children by the score. The great race of the day had just been run, and the close lines of people, on either side of the course, suddenly breaking up and pouring into it, imparted a new liveliness to the scene, which was again all busy movement. Some hurried eagerly to catch a glimpse of the winning horse, others darted to and fro, searching, no less eagerly, for the carriages they had left in quest of better stations. Here, a little knot gathered round a pea and thimble table to watch the plucking of some unhappy greenhorn, and there, another proprietor with his confederates in various disguises, one man in spectacles, another, with an eyeglass and a stylish hat, a third, dressed as a farmer well, to do in the world, with his top coat over his arm, and his flash notes in a large leathern pocketbook, and all with heavy-handled whips to represent most innocent country fellows who had trotted there on horseback sought, by loud and noisy talk and pretended play, to entrap some unwary customer, while the gentlemen confederates of more villainous aspect still, in clean linen and good clothes, betrayed their close interest in the concern by the anxious furtive glance they cast on all newcomers. These would be hanging on the outskirts of a wide circle of people assembled round some itinerant juggler, opposed, in his turn, by a noisy band of music, or the classic game of Ring the Bull, apostrophe while ventriloquists holding dialogues with wooden dolls, and fortune-telling women smothering the cries of real babies, divided with them, and many more, the general attention of the company. Drinking tents were full, glasses began to clink in carriages, hampers to be unpacked, tempting provisions to be set forth, knives and forks to rattle, champagne corks to fly, eyes to brighten that were not dull before, and pickpockets to count their gains during the last heat. The attention so recently strained on one object of interest was now divided among a hundred, and look where you would, there was a motley assemblage of feasting, laughing, talking, begging, gambling, and mummery. Of the gambling booths there was a plentiful show, flourishing in all the splendor of carpeted ground, striped hangings, crimson cloth, pinnacled roofs, geranium pots, and livery servants. There were the Strangers Clubhouse, the Athenaeum Clubhouse, the Hampton Clubhouse, the Street James Clubhouse, and half a mile of clubhouses to play in, and there were Rouge et Noir, French Hazard, and other games to play at. It is into one of these booths that our story takes its way. Fitted up with three tables for the purposes of play, and crowded with players and lookers-on, it was, although the largest place of the kind upon the course, intensely hot, notwithstanding that a portion of the canvas roof was rolled back to admit more air, and there were two doors for a free passage in and out. Excepting one or two men who, each with a long roll of half-crowns, checkered with a few stray sovereigns, in his left hand, staked their money at every roll of the ball with a business-like sedateness which showed that they were used to it, and had been playing all day, and most probably all the day before, there was no very distinctive character about the players, who were chiefly young men, apparently attracted by curiosity, or staking small sums as part of the amusement of the day, with no very great interest in winning or losing. There were two persons present, however, who, as peculiarly good specimens of a class, deserve a passing notice. Of these, one was a man of 6 or 8 and 50, who sat on a chair near one of the entrances of the booth, with his hands folded on the top of his stick, and his chin appearing above them. He was a tall, fat, long-bodied man, buttoned up to the throat in a light green coat, which made his body look still longer than it was. He wore, besides, drab breeches and gaiters, a white neckerchief, and a broad-brimmed white hat. Amid all the buzzing noise of the games, and the perpetual passing in and out of the people, he seemed perfectly calm and abstracted, without the smallest particle of excitement in his composition. He exhibited no indication of weariness, nor, to a casual observer, of interest either. There he sat, quite still and collected. Sometimes, but very rarely, he nodded to some passing face, or beckoned to a waiter, to obey a call from one of the tables. The next instant he subsided into his old state. He might have been some profoundly deaf old gentleman, who had come in to take a rest, or he might have been patiently waiting for a friend, without the least consciousness of anybody's presence, or fixed in a trance, or under the influence of opium. People turned round, and looked at him. He made no gesture, caught nobody's eye, let them pass away, and others come on, and be succeeded by others, and took no notice. When he did move, it seemed wonderful how he could have seen anything to occasion it. And so, in truth, it was. But there was not a face, that passed in or out, which this man failed to see. Not a gesture at any one of the three tables, that was lost upon him. Not a word, spoken by the bankers, but reached his ear. Not a winner or loser he could not have marked. And he was the proprietor of the place. The other presided over the Rouge et Noir table. He was probably some 10 years younger, and was a plump, paunchy, sturdy-looking fellow, with his underlip a little pursed, from a habit of counting money inwardly as he paid it, but with no decidedly bad expression in his face, which was rather an honest and jolly one than otherwise. He wore no coat, the weather being hot, and stood behind the table with a huge mound of crowns and half-crowns before him, and a cash box for notes. This game was constantly playing. Perhaps 20 people would be staking at the same time. This man had to roll the ball, to watch the stakes as they were laid down, to gather them off the color which lost, to pay those who won, to do it all with the utmost dispatch, to roll the ball again, and to keep this game perpetually alive. He did it all with a rapidity absolutely marvelous. Never hesitating, never making a mistake, never stopping, and never ceasing to repeat such unconnected phrases as the following, which, partly from habit, and partly to have something appropriate and businesslike to say, he constantly poured out with the same monotonous emphasis, and in nearly the same order, all day long. Rouge et Noir from Paris. Gentlemen, make your game and back your own opinions any time, while the ball rolls Rouge et Noir from Paris. Gentlemen, it's a French game. Gentlemen, I brought it over myself, I did indeed. Rouge et Noir from Paris, black wins black. Stop a minute, sir, and I'll pay you, directly 2 there, half a pound there, 3 there and 1 there, gentlemen. The balls are rolling any time, sir, while the ball rolls. The beauty of this game is that you can double your stakes or put down your money, gentlemen, any time while the ball rolls. Black again, black wins. I never saw such a thing. I never did in all my life. Upon my word, I never did. If any gentleman had been backing the black in the last 5 minutes, he must have won £5.40 in 4 rolls of the ball. He must indeed. Gentlemen, we've port, sherry, cigars, and most excellent champagne. Here, Whiter, bring a bottle of champagne, and let's have a dozen or 15 cigars here, and let's be comfortable, gentlemen, and bring some clean glasses anytime while the ball rolls. I lost £137 yesterday, gentlemen, at one roll of the ball. I did indeed. How do you do, sir? ... Recognizing some knowing gentleman without any alter change of voice, and giving a wink so slight that it seems an accident. Will you take a glass of sherry, sir? Here, Whiter. Bring a clean glass, and hand the sherry to this gentleman, and hand it round. Will you, waiter? This is the Rue Jaynor from Paris. Gentlemen, any time while the ball rolls. Gentlemen, make your game, and back your own opinions. It's the Rue Jaynor from Paris. Quite a new game. I brought it over myself. I did indeed, gentlemen. The ball's a-rolling. ... This officer was busily plying his vocation, when half a dozen persons sauntered through the booth, to whom, but without stopping either in his speech or work, he bowed respectfully, at the same time directing, by a look, the attention of a man beside him to the tallest figure in the group, in recognition of whom the proprietor pulled off his hat. This was Sir Mulberry Hawk, with whom were his friend and pupil, and a small train of gentlemanly dressed men, of characters more doubtful than obscure. The proprietor, in a low voice, bade Sir Mulberry good day. Sir Mulberry, in the same tone, bade the proprietor go to the devil, and turned to speak with his friends. There was evidently an irritable consciousness about him, that he was an object of curiosity, on this first occasion of showing himself in public after the accident that had befallen him, and it was easy to perceive that he appeared on the race course that day more in the hope of meeting with a great many people who knew him, and so getting over as much as possible of the annoyance at once, than with any purpose of enjoying the sport. There yet remained a slight scar upon his face, and whenever he was recognized, as he was almost every minute by people sauntering in and out, he made a restless effort to conceal it with his glove, showing how keenly he felt the disgrace he had undergone. Ah! Hawk, said one very sprucely dressed personage in a Newmarket coat, a choice neckerchief, and all other accessories of the most unexceptionable kind. How do you do, old fellow? This was a rival trainer of young noblemen and gentlemen, and the person of all others whom Sir Mulberry most hated and dreaded to meet. They shook hands with excessive cordiality. And how are you now, old fellow, hey? ... said Sir Mulberry. That's right, said the other. How do you do, Verisoft? He's a little pulled down, our friend here. Rather out of condition still, hey? It should be observed that the gentleman had very white teeth, and that when there was no excuse for laughing, he generally finished with the same monosyllable, which he uttered so as to display them. He's in very good condition. There's nothing the matter with him, said the young man carelessly. Upon my soul, I'm glad to hear it, rejoined the other. Have you just returned from Brussels? We only reached town late last night, said Lord Frederick. Sir Mulberry turned away, to speak to one of his own party, and feigned not to hear. Now, upon my life, said the friend, affecting to speak in a whisper, it's an uncommonly bold and game thing in Hawk to show himself so soon. I say it advisedly. There's a vast deal of courage in it. You see, he has just rusticated long enough to excite curiosity, and not long enough for men to have forgotten that deuced unpleasant by-the-by, you know the rights of the affair, of course. Why did you never give those confounded papers the lie? I seldom read the papers, but I looked in the papers for that, and may I be apostrophe, look in the papers, apostrophe interrupted Sir Mulberry, turning suddenly round. Tomorrow no, next day, will you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, upon my life, my dear fellow, I seldom or never read the papers, apostrophe said the other, shrugging his shoulders, but I will, at your recommendation. What shall I look for? Apostrophe, good day, apostrophe said Sir Mulberry, turning abruptly on his heel, and drawing his pupil with him. Falling, again, into the loitering, careless pace at which they had entered, they lounged out, arm in arm. I won't give him a case of murder to read, apostrophe muttered Sir Mulberry with an oath, but it shall be something very near it, if whipcord cuts and bludgeons bruise. Apostrophe, his companion said nothing, but there was something in his manner which galled Sir Mulberry to add, with nearly as much ferocity, as if his friend had been Nicholas himself. I sent Jenkins to old Nickleby before 8 o'clock this morning. He's a staunch one. He was back with me before the messenger. I had it all from him in the first 5 minutes. I know where this hound is to be met with, time and place both. But there's no need to talk. Tomorrow will soon be here. Apostrophe, and what's to be done tomorrow? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Lord Frederick. Sir Mulberry Hawk honored him with an angry glance, but condescended to return no verbal answer to this inquiry. Both walked sullenly on, as though their thoughts were busily occupied, until they were quite clear of the crowd, and almost alone, when Sir Mulberry wheeled round to return. Stop, apostrophe said his companion, I want to speak to you in earnest. Don't turn back. Let us walk here, a few minutes. Apostrophe, what have you to say to me, that you could not say yonder as well as here? Apostrophe, apostrophe, returned his mentor, disengaging his arm. Hawk, apostrophe, rejoined the other, tell me, I must know. Apostrophe, must know, apostrophe, interrupted the other disdainfully. You, go on. If you must know, of course there's no escape for me. Must know. Apostrophe, must ask then, apostrophe, returned Lord Frederick, and must press you for a plain and straightforward answer. Is what you have just said only a mere whim of the moment, occasioned by your being out of humor and irritated, or is it your serious intention, and one that you have actually contemplated? Apostrophe, apostrophe, why, don't you remember what passed on the subject one night, when I was laid up with a broken limb? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Sir Mulberry, with a sneer. Perfectly well. Apostrophe, then take that for an answer, in the devil's name, apostrophe, replied Sir Mulberry, and ask me for no other. Apostrophe, such was the ascendancy he had acquired over his dupe, and such the latter's general habit of submission, that, for the moment, the young man seemed half afraid to pursue the subject. He soon overcame this feeling, however, if it had restrained him at all, and retorted angrily. If I remember what passed at the time you speak of, I expressed a strong opinion on this subject, and said that, with my knowledge, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.